Epilogue. The Island. The shack had a good roof over it, made of woven fibrous material, apparently coconut, and covered 6 or 8 inches deep by layers of coconut leaves laid with the stems up in a sort of shingle arrangement. The framework was formed of upright poles tied together by a fiber that we assumed to be either coconut or some other native growth. The building was about 8 feet wide by 10 feet long. Some 2.5 feet off the ground were 3 poles that ran the width of the shack. There was nothing under them. There were 2 smaller poles connecting the uprights, not nailed but lashed with some sort of native-made string. The shack had a ridge pole and arch beams, as any other house would have. The walls were of matting. Just overhead were rafters, and resting on them were 3 roughly hewn planks about 12 feet long by 8 feet wide. On the floor we found a pile of coconut mats, 3 feet wide by 8 feet long. We didn't inspect the shack closely that night. We were too weak to pay much attention to our surroundings. Our main trouble, physically, was in trying to balance ourselves, but by holding onto the uprights we managed to get about. However, I had enough strength left to get those 3 planks down from the rafters to form the framework for a makeshift bed of mats. We piled about 1/2 the mats on the planks, and Tony and I slept there that night. With the rest of the mats, we made a bed on the ground for Jean. Right outside our shelter, there was a dense grove of coconut trees, and Jean decided to gather some nuts. When he got outside, the wind was so strong that he couldn't stand against it, even by using his stick to lean on, and the coral hurt his feet, so he had to give up and come back to the shack. It was with reluctance that we gave up the idea of food that night, but we thought the wind would die down by morning. I spied a couple of chickens in the jungle, but of course they frightened easily, and we were in no condition to attempt chasing them down. About 1/2 hour later, Jean saw 2 men approaching up the beach, perhaps 300 yards away. He thought they saw us, but they turned and went in the other direction. By now, the rising wind was blowing gusts of rain into our shelter, so we rigged one of the coconut mats to protect us. We didn't know it at the time, but this heavy wind from offshore was to develop into a hurricane the next day. The wind rose gradually, and it rained steadily. We spent a miserable night. The wind kept blowing the mats with which we tried to cover ourselves, and the rough woven fiber scratched painfully against our sunburn. We were unable to sleep at all. The next morning, early, the first thing I did was to look around the shack and try to patch it where the wind, during the night, had blown off the siding. In casting about for materials for this repair, we found several fish lines in the rafters with poles, but I refused to use them. I knew how the natives would feel about our breaking their lines, which were probably not easy to obtain in these parts. Instead, we gathered up some coconut leaves. Using the fiber from these, we patched the mat walls pretty well. The shack was well made, but seemed to be very old. It was rotting in places. I thought it must have stood there a long while. While looking about in the rafters, I found a thick book in a strange language. It developed that this was a native Bible. While we were still working on the patching job, we saw a native coming toward us from the beach. It had stopped raining. I grabbed my police whistle, which I had laid on the ground the night before, and blew a loud blast. The native stopped and looked at us, evidently aghast. It was obvious that he couldn't understand our being there. After I blew my whistle 2 or 3 more times, he finally gathered his wits and ran up to see what was going on. We were sitting on the floor, leaning against the wall where we had been patching the mats. The native stared, fascinated. We all pointed to our mouths, trying to signify that we were hungry. He could see from our emaciated condition that we were in a bad state, so it didn't take him long to get the idea. He held up his hand reassuringly and dashed off into the coconut jungle. In a few minutes he was back, with several coconut kernels. I've never seen this particular cultivation of coconut anywhere but on this island. As I learned later, the baby coconut tree sprouts from a nut. When it has grown to a height of perhaps 2.5 feet, the little plant is broken off. Then the natives crack open the nut, and it is filled entirely with a white, fibrous, vegetable-like substance. The coconut meat as we know it has entirely disappeared and has been replaced by this new growth, which is very easy to digest. The native broke open the kernels and handed them to us. We snatched them and began munching immediately. I have never tasted anything more appetizing than those coconut kernels were that morning. As we ate, the native made signs to us that he was going for help. He pointed to my police whistle and held out his hand, smiling encouragingly. I gave him the whistle, and immediately he turned and ran off among the coconut trees, tooting the whistle vigorously. We looked at each other in great relief. At least the natives were friendly. Our visitor was gone for perhaps a half hour. He returned with a party of several natives and a man who seemed to be the leader. This was the resident commissioner. Not knowing who we were, he had brought assistance in case we might turn out to be enemies. I should explain here, perhaps, that as this account is written, the events are still so recent that the Navy intelligence considers it wiser for the security of our country that I withhold the identification of the island on which we landed, and the close location of the particular area of the South Pacific in which our adventure occurred. I can say, however, that the island was a tiny one, and so far from the trade routes or any other regular contact with the world that probably few who read this chronicle have ever heard of it. At any rate, the first native recognized from our eyes that we were white men. By our burned skins, he could not tell whether we were white, brown, yellow, red, or black. He was quite sure, however, that we were not Japanese. He told the commissioner that he thought we were New Zealanders or Australians, so of course the commissioner expected us to be from allies of his country, as of course we were. He was taking no chances, though, and brought some manpower along. There are no weapons on the island except knives. The commissioner's first question was as to our nationality. Upon learning that we were American sailors, he showed his delight immediately. He explained then several peculiar aspects of our experience with the shack. In the first place, we had got into the only taboo shack on that section of the island. The various sheds we saw were for the storing of copra. In fact, there were about 4 tons of copra in the shacks at this time, but the one we had staggered into was the only shack that had a taboo. It was reserved for the higher-ranking men of the island people. The natives were not only afraid to enter, they hesitated even to come near. The 2 natives of the night before, who Jean thought had seen us, did see us indeed, but they were afraid to say so for fear they would incur the wrath of their chief for venturing so near the forbidden. The commissioner was curious as to how we had reached this particular part of the island. Had we walked there? We merely turned and pointed seaward. He was astounded. That, he said, was impossible. He could not believe we had come upon this beach from the sea. No one had ever come over that reef and lived to tell the tale. It was our turn to be astonished, but after a surprised glance at each other, we pointed to our little raft, tied to the piling near the shack. The commissioner walked out excitedly and took a look at the raft. He examined it carefully, feeling it all over with his hands, the natives chattering among themselves and looking back at us wonderingly. Then he came slowly back into the shack, put his hands on his hips, and grinned down at us. He just grinned, speechless, shaking his head from side to side. We were now beginning to feel like curiosities for fair. The commissioner explained that it was considered impossible for any man to come over that reef. There was a lookout tower on this beach, he said, and it was constantly manned by sharp-eyed natives on the watch for enemy craft, but as a rule, they didn't consider it necessary to pay any attention to the impassable reef. For this reason, and also perhaps because our boat was so small, our fight against the waves and our last faltering march across the beach had gone unnoticed by the practiced watchers only a few yards off. Our dialogue meant nothing to the natives, who spoke no English, but they knew that something unusual was afoot. When the commissioner explained to them who we were and what we had done, when they were told that we had actually come in over this reef in such a craft, they just stood around with their mouths open, staring at us as if we were supermen or gods. I was becoming a little embarrassed by their awe-stricken regard, so I tried to explain to the commissioner that our flat-bottomed airborne raft drew no water and thus enabled us to cross the giant breakers where the heavy native-built canoes might fail. The commissioner just shook his head again, his admiring grin spreading until I thought it would cut his face in two. The natives were still staring at us, saying nothing but oh and ah. At length the commissioner gave an order in the island language, and the husky, handsome brown natives gathered us into their arms like babies and set off with us at a swift pace. We went toward the leeward side of the island, passing through beautiful groves of coconut trees and other tropical growth. I was still able to take some interest in what I saw as we went along, and I noted numerous taro beds. The natives carried us a mile or more until we arrived at the commissioner's residence on the leeward side. The house stood on the highest point on the island, about 40 feet above sea level. I learned that we were on one of the tiny atolls that dot the South Seas. The particular group to which this one belonged is one of the most isolated in all the South Pacific. There is more than one island in the group, but the others are deserted and are visited only for the gathering of coconuts for the copra trade. Yesterday, in choosing one of the two visible islands as our objective, we had the fortune to pick the only inhabited one within many hundreds of miles. We learned, when we were able to check out our reckonings later, that we had completely circled the entire small group of islets before sighting our first land on the 34th day. In all, we covered approximately 1,000 miles in the raft, but actually, from the point at which we landed our plane to this island, the distance was about 750 miles. We received a warm welcome from the commissioner's wife. She put us to bed at once in a large room at one end of the beautiful, wide, tropical-style building, and set about preparing us our first real meal since we left the ship. This was the kind of house they try to duplicate in the South Seas movies. It was built of native hardwoods, so hard, the commissioner told us when we were able to talk more, that the termites wouldn't attempt to bite into it, taking any other kind of wood in preference. The framework was constructed of upright poles, all uniform in size, 4 to 5 inches in diameter. The poles were smooth and round and didn't seem to taper, so evidently this wood comes from a straight, high tree. No nails were used in the construction. Everything was tied together with some kind of cord that resembled rattan. The sides and ceilings were made of beautiful hand-woven coconut panels. The roof over this intricate matwork consisted of layers of coconut leaves piled 6 or 8 inches deep, like the roof of the shack we had found. It was proved to us later that this roof was wind and rainproof.